We're now in the third week of our series that's about how to live a more fulfilling life, a more fulfilling life. I think it's obvious that most people want to be successful. They want to accomplish something good and great. Few people aspire to mediocrity. I doubt you aspire to mediocrity. But the thing is that success can be defined in many ways. Some people strive to be the best at their jobs, climbing the corporate ladder of success. Others work to be the best parent and raise happy and successful children who get into the best colleges and achieve their dreams. Still others push their bodies to the limit with extreme fitness so that they can be in peak physical condition. In whatever facet of life we're interested in, I think we all desire to excel, and many of us are driven to be the best and the brightest. But success is not the same thing as fulfillment. Accomplishing our personal goals and achieving our individual dreams makes life purposeful, but not necessarily fulfilling. Fulfillment runs deeper than success. It runs deeper even than happiness or satisfaction or contentment with your life. Fulfillment, as we've been saying throughout this series, is the sense that your existence in life makes sense, makes a difference, and actually holds ultimate value and meaning. In the first week of the series, we looked at why a lot of people in our world today, I think deep down, feel unfulfilled. They don't feel fulfilled. And the underlying problem, as we've defined it, is the widespread phenomenon in our society today that replaces religion with other rituals and activities. You can turn anything into a religion, right? Work, sports, politics, outdoor activities, even family time. You can turn that into a religion. The problem is that as satisfying as those experiences can be, they don't actually deliver on the promise of true and lasting fulfillment. And the other thing is that most of us are so pressed for time, we're running from one thing to the next to get everything done on our checklists of success, that in the small amount of free time we do have, we don't do the thing that we actually need to do to live a fulfilling life, and that is work on our faith, work on our spiritual lives. Little by little, many of us gradually excuse ourselves from the harder path to fulfillment that comes from actively working on our relationship with God. That voice deep within us, you know, it just keeps telling us to make God the center of our lives, but it's drowned out, right? It's drowned out sometimes by all the distractions and the fun things to do in this world, and I love to do them too, believe me. We take the invitation from God to grow closer to Him for granted sometimes, and we think there'll be another day to get to that. Yes, God, I know, and tomorrow I'm going to get to that. But what if that day never comes? Every day, God invites us to a more fulfilling life by growing in our faith and in our love for Him and for other people. But it means that we have to be willing to overcome the excuses that hold us back from accepting that invitation and growing in faith. And throughout this series, we've talked to you about the various things you can do to grow in your faith. We call it a clear path to discipleship. Things like joining a small group, helping out in a ministry, serving the poor in one of our missions, ramping up your giving because money is a spiritual issue, or ramping up your prayer time. But before we can do any of those things, before we can actually accept the invitation from God to live a more fulfilling life by working on our faith, we have to answer one fundamental question first. One all-important question, and that's what I want to talk with you about tonight. What is that question? Well, we're going to look at a passage from the Gospel of Matthew to help us figure out what that question is. We heard it in the Gospel reading tonight. In the passage, we see the Pharisees again. The Pharisees are the beloved bad guys of the Bible. They're the bad guys of the Bible because they are deeply opposed to Jesus. The Pharisees are a sect of religious leaders. You probably knew that. But they were really jealous of Jesus and his growing popularity among the crowds. You know, he just came out of nowhere. He was this charismatic leader, and now he was drawing large crowds, and he was dominating the religious scene. The Pharisees didn't like that. So they started plotting how to discredit Jesus. And to do that, the Pharisees teamed up with another group of people called the Herodians. These are people you may not have heard of, but let me tell you, the Pharisees and the Herodians, they made really strange bedfellows. You see, the Pharisees hated Rome. They hated anything to do with Rome. They hated the fact that Rome was occupying the Jewish land at that time. The Herodians, on the other hand, were part of the ruling class. And so they supported Rome politically so that they could stay in their positions of power. But this unholy alliance between these two groups, between the Pharisees and the Herodians, was forged solely for the purpose of bringing down Jesus. So how do they do that? They go to him and they say, "Teacher, we know that you're a truthful man." They start off with flattery. And so they go on flattering Jesus. "We know that you teach the way of God according to the truth. We know that you don't care about anybody's opinion, and we know that you don't care about anybody's status." So they compliment him, but those compliments were not from the heart. They were trying to loosen him up so that he would drop his defenses and be caught off guard. And then they lay the trap, and it comes in the form of a question, and here it is. They ask him, "Is it lawful to pay the census tax to Caesar or not?" This was an explosive question. They were trying to force Jesus into an impossible dilemma. You see, if Jesus said that it was lawful under Jewish law to pay this tax to Rome, he would be considered a Roman sympathizer, and the crowds would abandon him or maybe even attack him. Everybody hated Rome. But on the other hand, if he said that paying the tax was unlawful and that Jewish people shouldn't do it, he would be turned in by the Pharisees and the Herodians as a traitor and arrested by Roman authorities for attempting to incite a tax revolt. There seemed no way out of this bind for Jesus. But of course, it's Jesus, so he found a way. He said this, "Why are you testing me, you hypocrites? Show me the coin. Show me the coin that pays the census tax." And then stupidly, they handed him the Roman coin. Why was that stupid? Because they fell right into Jesus' own trap. By producing the coin, the Pharisees exposed themselves publicly as hypocrites. Even though they opposed Roman taxation, they obviously paid it because they had the coin in their possession. Well, then Jesus says to them, "Whose image is this and whose inscription?" They replied, of course, "Caesar's," right? If you've ever seen this coin, it's a Roman denarius and it kind of looks like this. On one side of the coin, it has the image of the Roman emperor and then the inscription, "The son of the divine Augustus." Divine Augustus. You see, Caesar was considered to be a god or like a god, very close to a god, a quasi-god, and that was repugnant to Jewish people. So to carry a coin around in their pocket that claimed that Caesar was a god, that would have been revolting. The other side of the coin was just as bad. It declared Caesar to be the high priest over everyone he governed. That was also repugnant, to carry around a coin that declared Caesar to be their high priest, No Jew would want that. But then Jesus foils this whole conspiracy in the final lines of the story when he slips through the trap and he says this, "Repay to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, the coin, and to God what belongs to God." Jesus' answer goes way deeper than the subject of taxes. It goes way deeper than how you and I are supposed to spend our money. That's not what it's really about. It brings up the question, it calls up the question, what belongs to God? Everything, right? That's an easy question. Everything belongs to God. Everything we are, everything we have, everything we enjoy belongs to God. Our whole lives belong to God. And so Jesus strikes right at the heart of what it means to belong to God. It means giving him everything, not just a coin, but everything. And so, if you want to live a more fulfilling life, if you want to accept God's invitation to grow in faith, the first question we all have to ask ourselves in our heart of hearts is this fundamental question: to whom do I belong? Like, really? The word belong comes from the English word langian, which means to go along with or to be in the right place. And I love that definition because I think every one of us longs for a place that we know is for us, a place that we know we belong in. I think the most alienating human experience is to feel alone, to never be known or seen, to be overlooked, to be ignored. By design, God made us relational. We all need to belong somewhere, to find connection somewhere, to be part of something bigger than ourselves somewhere. And we all draw our sense of identity, of who we are, from engagement with other people who share our same goals and values and belief systems. The problem is that people who lack a sense of belonging, well, they're more likely to become lonely and depressed, to suffer health problems and be less productive at work. Most people are members of a lot of different groups and communities. You're probably members of a lot of different groups and communities. You probably are a member of your school. If you're working, you're probably a member of your company. You're a member maybe of a club that you belong to, or a neighborhood, or a political party, or a friend group, or some other kind of affinity group. We all have groups that we belong to, and they're all good. Well, most are good. Most are good. But the problem is, in the long run, those groups and communities can only offer us a limited path to fulfillment. And the most fundamental question any of us can ask about ourselves is, where do we experience an ultimate sense of belonging? To experience deep and lasting fulfillment, you have to be able to answer honestly whether or not you truly belong to God. It's easy to say, but it's harder to live out, because it means setting priorities and committing resources like time and money to growing in faith and pursuing a deeper relationship with God. This week, I encourage all of us to take a long look at our weekly schedules and our bank accounts. Those two things are the most reliable indications of where you find your belonging. As Jesus once said, "Where your treasure is, there also will your heart be." Wherever you spend your discretionary time and discretionary money, after you do all the things you have to do and pay everything you have to pay, wherever you spend that time and money, the most is where you have chosen to belong. There's nothing wrong with taking seriously our day-to-day commitments to work and family and community. That's what good and responsible people do. But if God always takes last place, if your prayer life is downgraded to a remote possibility when you're able to spare a few minutes during the day, If your financial giving to God's church and to the poor is the last item on your list of bills, if and when there's enough left over. If your engagement with the community of Christ followers, the church, is kind of hit or miss. If you're too busy to help others by serving in a ministry or in a mission, it's going to be harder to say that you really belong to God. I know that sounds harsh, but as I read these lines, I judge myself. And I remember the old adage, failure is trading what we want most for what we want at the moment. Our highest obligation in life is to offer our whole lives to the Lord. It needs to be the first priority if you want to experience genuine fulfillment. Long ago, God spoke to a man. His name was Cyrus. We heard about it in the first reading. Cyrus was the king of Persia. He didn't know a thing about God. He didn't know anything about the Jewish God, who is the one true God. And yet, he became the vehicle through which God allowed his people to return home from a foreign nation after a long period of exile. He's the one through whom God gave a second chance to the people of Israel. And so God said to Cyrus, I have called you by name. I've called you by name, giving you a title, though you do not know me. God used Cyrus for his purposes, and God wants to use you too for his purposes. God wants you to choose to belong to him. One of my favorite jobs as a priest is to baptize babies. You can see, this is a picture, one of my favorite pictures of baptisms I've performed. This was years ago when I was younger and plumper. But I remember holding that baby. It was so fun. But in that baptism rite, it calls for the priest to trace the sign of the cross on the child's forehead. And I always tell the family as I'm doing that, that it's kind of like a spiritual tattoo, symbolizing that from that day forward, that child will forever, forever belong to Christ. No matter what happens in their lives after that, nothing can break that bond. It can only be weakened by our own neglect. So, if you're just starting on a journey of faith, or you have no idea where you really are on that journey, God calls you by name and stands ready to open the doors to a far more fulfilling life for you. If there's someone here tonight or watching online and you're just starting on your journey of faith, or maybe you haven't been baptized yet, we'd love to help you with that. We've got a group right now called Starting Point. They've only met a couple of weeks. It's not too late. And this is a group of people who are beginning their journey to become Catholic. You can find out more on our website. But if you're already baptized, and maybe you're already coming to Mass regularly, perhaps even every week, thank you for that. Congratulations. But maybe you also still struggle to make God a priority in your life the rest of the week. If that's the case, there's lots of opportunities to take that next step in faith. Just check out our website, sthilary.org. One last thing. There's a church in Southern California that I love to visit whenever I'm down there. It's a big church with lots of people attending. It would be easy to feel anonymous there, except at the entrance, there's this huge neon, imagine the neon sign. It's bold and it's blue, and it reads, "You belong here." I want to get one of those signs to put out in the vestibule here, but I think you would kill me. But as simple and perhaps as trite as that may seem, whenever I see it, I do feel like I belong there. And the truth is, you belong to God. You belong here. Our vision is to become a church where everyone loves to belong. And so whether you are worshiping with us here in person or attending online, Wherever you are in this big world, I want you to know you always belong to God, and you belong here. And my sincerest hope is that you want to belong with us. And our desperate hope is that you truly want to belong to God.